Hi, Randy. What's going on?
Hi again, Jim. I always laugh because we talk right before the show starts, so it just seems funny timing to throw it in the middle of a conversation. So this week we're going to look at two-time dimension physics, which is a really, I think, fascinating development in theoretical physics. And hopefully you understand the technical intrigue of this theory better than I do, because this is some really next-level stuff.
Okay, there's intrigue. I didn't hear about the intrigue.
Well, when you look at the equations and try to read how Isaac Barrs talks about theoretical physics, well, he's been in superstring theory for like 30 years or something. So he's so used to manipulating physics at this incredibly sublime and abstract level that I find it really hard to follow all of the different terminology. A lot of that stuff is, you know, you're talking, so this is somebody that, you know, over lunch works on higher dimensional physics and superstring theory and stuff like that, and M theory now. So it's a very challenging material, but the model, it looks to me like the model that he's presenting is really exciting and fascinating. So I thought it'd be really fun to talk about.
Okay, well, we can look at this a little bit. So what's going on here is that he's taking a six-dimensional space-time, I guess, and saying that we are only seeing a shadow, a four-dimensional shadow of the six-dimensional reality. Is that how I understand this? Am I understanding this right?
He uses that exact example in a couple of his lectures that he gives on this theory. And he shows this object in the three-dimensional space kind of hanging in the middle of a room. And he shows how when you light it from different directions, it looks like a completely different object. And we're sort of like the Flatlanders who just see the shadow on that two-dimensional surface. And it looks like something very different than what's reflected on the other wall at a 90-degree angle. But sometimes we get lucky and kind of figure out that there's a relationship. And so he describes this as how we sort of unpuzzle these symmetries in our physical laws, as we kind of do experiments and figure out and get the contour of these things. And sometimes we get lucky and figure out, hey, wait, there's a relationship between these two things. Now, I guess that's where, I think it was Noether? Emmy Noether. Is that how it's pronounced, Noether?
I think Noether is the way I heard it pronounced when I was in school.
This is when physics started getting into the modern age, when I think physicists and mathematicians kind of got together and realized, hey, these conservation laws are just a consequence of these symmetries in nature that are embedded within the way the physical law works. So let's see if we can develop more sophisticated physical ideas based on these symmetries in nature. And we ended up with general relativity and the standard model of physics, which are largely based on these kind of symmetries. What Isaac Barrs is doing is taking it to an even more abstract and kind of sublime level by seeing this reality that we live in as a projection of these higher dimensional symmetries.
Yeah, so this all has something to do with symmetries that I think he noticed in the Lagrangian somewhere.
Yeah, we talked a lot about the conjugate variables in quantum mechanics when we were doing Physics FM, the Quantum Paradoxes podcast. And I think the fundamental question that started him on this path was the idea that there appears to be a symmetry in quantum mechanical mathematics between position and momentum. And he said, well, in order to make that a true symmetry, you'd have to have a time dimension associated with position. And so from that, he ended up arriving at this model of two time dimensions and four spatial dimensions.
Yeah, he also needed that extra spatial dimension as well. And so he was looking at that and he was saying, okay, everything that we look at should not depend on where we are or what we're doing or something like that. And basic idea behind relativity. And so he's taking this idea about relativity and he's looking for it in these Hamiltonians in superstring theory or wherever exactly he was looking at things, but I think it was probably superstring theory. He's looking at this and he says, well, this should probably be something that you can exchange, right? This position and the momentum. You should be able to exchange them. It doesn't matter what you're looking at as the position coordinate, right? It shouldn't really matter. The laws of physics should still work. So you should be able to switch their roles and everything should still work as far as the physics is concerned. And so that's where he gets that two-time stuff, is that he needed an extra dimension of time in order for that to work. And so this is a little bit different than, say, earlier ideas about having a second time dimension, which existed. But what happened with those is that people said, well, what would happen if you have a second time dimension? And so you have a completely unconstrained second time dimension. And when that happens, you can get all sorts of strange things happening with causality. You can get things just sort of appearing out of nowhere for no particular reason. I guess ghosts is what they call that. and other things that, you know, don't make physicists very happy because, you know, you don't really see them. But the way that Bars has put this together, because these extra dimensions, this extra spatial dimension, this extra temporal dimension come from this symmetry, they're constrained by that symmetry. And he goes through in these papers that we looked at and some other places, showing that basically if you project these things right, that symmetry that he's talking about constrains everything so that you don't get ghosts, you don't get causality violations just popping out of nowhere.
Yeah, for some reason, even though there's more dimensions and you'd think there'd be more degrees of freedom, the way they work together is it's very constrained, so that the limits that we know in our four-dimensional reality still apply, even though we're embedded within a six-dimensional higher reality. That's some pretty fascinating stuff. I'm not exactly sure how those constraints work, because the level of mathematics he's working at is pretty advanced for me. Even during one of his lectures, I noticed there were other scientists, I guess they were physicists in the room, and they looked pretty miserable trying to follow what he was saying on the board, because he's a virtuoso with that kind of abstract reasoning at the mathematical physical level. And I actually remember this guy's papers on superstring theory back when I was a physics student at USC in 86 and 88, and just being completely bewildered by the complexity of the mathematics and trying to follow anything that he was saying in his papers. But I was fascinated with them, so I was trying to read them all. And it's really exciting to see him having this idea, which is strikingly simpler than, of course, string theory and M theory, because you're only talking about six total dimensions. And it's a lot easier to make that leap to, okay, there's an extra dimension of time and there's an extra dimension of space. And then he finds that he can reproduce all of the laws of physics that we know today. The standard model, general relativity, all of it works perfectly within this higher dimensional physical theory. But the way that he goes over it, it looks very natural for all of these different phenomena that we observe to just almost kind of magically fall out of this higher dimensional, more symmetric theory. He applies one gauge transformation to this higher dimensional mathematical physics, and you get a particle in an expanding universe. You get all of the equations and all the behavior of that. And then you apply a different gauge transformation, and you get the atom and all of its spectra, like a hydrogen atom, all of its spectra. Or you apply a different gauge transformation, and you get like twisters and things like that. And it's just like one thing after another. It looks like you just change the gauge transformation and you end up with something which is something we observe, but you would never think is intimately related at this abstract mathematical level to a phenomena that appear to be completely different that we'd never thought to connect before. So that's one of the things that I found really exciting about this theory. It looks like a 21st century physics theory to me, you know, like this could be the next big deal. But it's weird. I don't see a lot of talk about it. What did you think of it?
Well, I mean, I thought it was quite interesting going through this. You know, it's very far out of where I normally live. This gets into places where I'm not really sure how to pronounce the words. You know, there are these things that I guess people are used to, like he keeps talking about the dilaton or something like that. And that seems to be very important in his model for a lot of reasons, especially when he starts talking about gravity.
We should mention that really quickly, because that's an absolutely fascinating point, is that when he calculated gravity in the six-dimensional physics, he finds that the gravitational constant appears as a shadow of the, I think it's, I don't know, I'm going to say dilaton, because I think it's about based on dilation. I don't know. And apparently that means that the gravitational constant would change at various phase transitions of the universe. Like, it would be different during the inflationary epoch, which is fascinating in and of itself, right? Like, don't you want to know what the value was? Maybe it wasn't even positive at that point, right? That it would be different at the grand unification energy. So if he's going to be able to basically predict constants out of this theory, that kind of, and they're no longer even constants, it does feel like maybe he's onto a more fundamental physics theory.
Definitely, that's what he's looking for, and that's what he's been trying to build up with this. So, I mean, yeah, that's where he's been moving towards. And, you know, it looks like this has been fairly successful at that. He's been able to go through and get things to work the way he thinks they should work. So, I mean, he's been able to produce string theory, like you said. He's been able to reproduce general relativity. And he does it without some of the stranger problems, like a hierarchy problem or something with particles and stuff like that. So it seems to be fairly nice, right? He's been able to show lots of things working the way he'd like them to work without too much of an issue. But I'm not sure how much he's really predicted is sort of the issue.
You're right. I didn't find as many predictions as I was hoping to find in here. But the one that struck my reading here was that he said that we're not going to find the axion particle because in the 60 physics that he has, you don't need it. That the strong CP problem that's been plaguing the strong force model, that apparently that gets smoothed out somehow, and so you don't need the axion particle. It says it doesn't exist. So if we find it, then that's a falsifiable prediction, right? And if we don't find it, then maybe he's right.
So we have to have some idea about exactly what's going on with that as well. So they've got, you know, and that particle they've been looking for a while, and I think they have not really had any success in finding it.
Yeah, and they've pinned their theories of dark matter, I think, on the axion.
That's true. And I think in his case here, he's trying to look at that dilaton is doing in its projection for dark matter. I think that's what I got out of that. I'm not sure. Was that what you understood?
I didn't really understand that, so I don't know. I didn't read all of the same papers that you did, because a couple points I was just like, okay, this is just so opaque with abstract theoretical speak that I'm going to listen to a lecture instead. And for some reason, it was a little easier for me to understand his lectures, even though he's got kind of an accent and he's using a lot of unfamiliar terms in a really rapid and casual way. That wasn't one of the things that he talked about. So,
well, I think we had an abortive attempt to try to talk about this a couple of months ago, where I'd suggested it and I didn't hear from you for a couple of days. So, well, you'd suggested that we talk about this. I didn't have a better idea for that week. And so I started reading through the articles you'd sent me in January sometime. And I couldn't make head or tail of this standard model as a 2T physics theory. I'd read through it and I had no idea what was going through it. But I think, you know, after reading a couple of the popular articles that I found, it didn't really say too much about what was really going on. And, you know, half the articles, I think, are looking at different things than what I would like to look at. But after reading that, I really understood what he was doing with the symmetry, and it made the other two papers, the big long papers that we have here about standard model and gravity with 2T physics, a little easier to cope with once you understand what he's trying to do with that symmetry, which is a little difficult to get an idea around. Even though it's fairly simple, it's just he's saying, okay, we have this sort of symmetry that we're working with because, you know, it's something that we can do with these equations. And in general, we don't want to unnecessarily privilege a particular reference frame if we can find some symmetry, some gauge symmetry in particular, to hold that down with. Because if we have a gauge symmetry, then what happens is that as long as we're living within that symmetry, we can modify the equations as much as we want, or we can choose how to look at a problem any way we want within that symmetry, and the final results won't change, right? The final thing that actually happens doesn't change as long as you're sitting within that symmetry, but it might be a lot easier in a lot of ways to look at things in that symmetry, and that tells us a lot more about the laws of nature than looking at things from a specific vantage point, right? As long as people were sitting around saying what happens when I throw a ball up in the air varies whether or not I'm on a moving ship or I'm standing on the land, you know, people didn't make a lot of progress in physics. And a lot of the history of physics is just going through and finding different symmetries to take account of.
And we made huge strides when we looked at translation symmetries and time symmetries, and when we figured out that electrical and magnetic fields were just translatable into one another through a translation symmetry. I'm not sure if that's a gauge symmetry or not, but I think what he did was that seemed to be brilliant was he took it to the next level and he said, well, instead of doing like position and momentum and translation, all these kind of physically observable symmetries, he looked at the gauge symmetries in phase space. And in phase space, like all of the position and momentum and energy and everything that a system can exist in is mapped, is sort of like an object. It's like almost like a complete capture of the Hamiltonian of a system, right? And so he was looking at the gauge symmetries of that, and he took that to a higher dimensional level. So he's capturing the entire system as an object, and then looking at how that affects the laws of physics in a higher dimension and what you can predict off of that It seems like a real stroke of genius, you know, to take that principle, which has been so beneficial to physics, into this more abstract but mathematically very powerful realm.
Well, and if it turns out to do all the things that he says it does, then probably it is. It seems to be very strong, because if he convinced the people who are actually working in these fields that what he's doing does what he says it's doing in these papers, mapping into, you know, the standard model, right? Mapping into general relativity, then possibly we have another unification right now. So yeah, I mean, I think that's what I'd really like to have seen somewhere, is some really strong criticism to see why there aren't more people working on it. Since he's been publishing for 20 years on the subject, you'd expect, if it was really fruitful for people.
Or if it had been disproven in some realm, you'd expect some kind of debate about it, right?
Yeah, if it was disproven, maybe not. Yes. But if it was fruitful for people, you'd expect to see more people publishing on it. If it was really disproven, maybe you'd see a couple of crazy people running around trying to poke holes on it. I guess what you'd see is he'd have stopped publishing. People would stop publishing his papers. They have not stopped publishing his papers. So obviously, it hasn't been disproven. So people think there's something in it, even if they don't think it's necessarily the way to go in the future. They think there might be something here, and it's something that's on the table for whenever, you know, things happen.
For some reason, I find it a much more palpable direction. Like, there's something about it which feels like the right direction for unification, you know, grand unification. It seems more accessible to me somehow, and more tangible and more rewarding than even superstring and M theories. He's gotten so much out of this with just six dimensions that it makes like 12 or 13 dimensions seem excessive. I'm not sure if those extra dimensions are required.
Yeah, well, these dimensions are a little bit different from Kaluza-Klein dimensions.
Right. Like, these are macroscopic dimensions, right?
Yeah, these should be large dimensions in some way. They're not tiny little things wrapped up on each other that you can't ever hope to really detect or something like that. So they're a different thing entirely. And I get some idea that his theory is not incompatible with having those Kaluza-Klein dimensions.
Yeah, he even mentions himself that he sees this as almost like a tool that can be applied to M theory to make it better. As a matter of fact, I think he got onto this while he was trying to solve some kind of gauge symmetry thing in M theory. And I guess he started this at the simplest level and tried to figure out if he could make an extra dimension of time work just out of principle, because it would solve these big problems that he was trying to solve. And then he found that a sympleptic group that satisfied the conditions that he needed without being overly restrictive. And it was this one, the four dimensions of space and the two dimensions of time, was the simplest form that could get him all of this gauge symmetry without eliminating all the degrees of freedom that you need to produce the universe. And lo and behold, he's able to apparently reproduce everything from massive relativistic particles to the hydrogen atom to the expanding universe and the Friedman-Walker metric and all this stuff out of this one physics idea. I don't know if he's offered any. Did he offer any of those derivations in those papers? I should have dug deeper into those.
So one of these, I'm certain it doesn't have any derivations in. The standard model is a 2T physics theory. I'm not sure where it was. I think this looks like a conference paper to me. This other one, because I don't really know the standards, could be derivations, but I'm not completely sure because I don't really know the standards for the field. And since I don't know where it was published or what it was doing, I don't have a really good idea about what's going on. That's sort of the problem with getting these papers off the archive sometimes, is I don't really know where it went. It looks reasonably complete, the one on gravity. But, I mean, depending on how much detail a real paper in the field takes, this could be sort of just an outline. I've definitely seen theoretical papers that are 40 journal pages long, and this is 23 pages in manuscript, so it's much, much shorter than that, maybe a fifth of that size.
I'm really intrigued. Apparently, when he finds the standard model using his theory, that there are differences. That's really exciting. Like, apparently, he's not just reproducing the existing mathematical edifice, but he's actually deriving it somehow and coming up with a slightly different model, which is how I guess he got rid of the axion.
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure what he's doing, but I think it looks like he's getting a much more specific idea about what's going on than you'd normally get with, say, a string theory. It looks to me like he's got much more restricted range of predictions. So the one of the big problems that people have with string theory, right, is that, you know, no matter what you want it to predict, it can predict it, right? It's got so many different variables, so many different constants that, you know, if you do an experiment, some clever theoretician can show that, you know, string theory is completely consistent with it. And it looks like there is enough here that if you're clever, you might be able to find some way to test it. I mean, the varying gravitational constant, for example, that is something that you think somebody might be able to test. Now, they might not be able to test it since, you know, I know there have been other people who've tried to postulate a varying gravitational constant in order to sort of get away from inflation. And I didn't. It's been a while since I read anything about that, and I haven't gone back to check. So I haven't checked that with what other people have said they need for their varying gravitational constant theories. But I know that other people have made those claims or have used those as sort of a basis for exploring what would happen in the universe if that happened. And I haven't heard anything about people saying, well, this is ruled out. I think that's something we can still hope will be true. Or I guess that's something that we can say nobody's found a way of testing, but it is something that you'd think that people could figure out a way to test.
Yeah, it's kind of astronomical observations or studying the CMB or something like that, right?
So they could figure out some way to get rid of that. And there are all sorts of things that were nice. For example, when he did the standard model thing, he's able to find the Higgs particle. So that's good because, you know, a few years after he published that, they found the Higgs particle.
That's right. So it's actually kind of a valid prediction, even though it had been predicted by the standard model already. But he didn't know that it would be found, right?
Yeah, he didn't know it would be found. Unfortunately, he didn't give a number here. You know, it's going to be found here.
That would have been nice if he gave the right mass ahead of time.
Yeah, because if he'd done that, then everything would be fine. But it turns out something strange here that I was reading and I didn't know before is that apparently in the standard model, the Higgs mass requires some sort of tachyon, but his theory does not.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
And I mean, that was just a line in the paper and I hadn't realized that previously. And I don't know how true that is, right? And to what extent that is. I mean, if it requires a few tachyons here and there, I don't...
What's a few tachyons between friends?
That's right.
We'll have dinner before we have this conversation and then make the plans later.
So that's one of the things that I thought was fairly nice, is that if something like that is required, right, then it's nice that he's gotten away from that, right?
Yeah, exactly. If he can eliminate the tachyon and the axion with one theory, he's really trucking.
So another thing that he's hoping for is that the dilaton will be observed at the LHC.
Oh, that's a particle that they'll be able to detect. Is that it? He's predicting a new particle?
I don't think it's a new. Okay. I don't think it's a new particle. I think it shows up in other places. So I think it's a field that he's using here, and he sees it as, you know, causing gravity and stuff like that in the other
higher dimensional model.
But it is something that he'd like to actually see.
Yeah, there was a few places where he claimed that there should be, that the LHC should be able to detect some of the phenomena that his theory predicts. But I haven't found any specifications of what those predictions are, except other than what you just mentioned.
Well, I'm sure that it's in one of the much more technical papers. So you know, you said you were having problems with some of these papers that you sent me, but, you know, compared to that thing we failed to read, or maybe read and failed to understand a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, the topological insulators paper?
Oh, you know, the math isn't that bad.
That's a monster. There was actually some mention of topological insulators. I know what it was. Is apparently something about topological insulators corresponds with the standard model, and they think that a Josephson junction should be able to detect axion particles. They still haven't managed to detect them, so it's looking less and less likely all the time that the axion actually exists.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure. But yeah, I mean, when I was looking at some background on the axion, it looked pretty bad for the axion.
It has an ad hoc quality to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, well, we need something, so let's make it up, and that'll make life better.
But isn't that how the Higgs came up, is that somebody was like, oh yeah, we need a particle that'll do this?
You know, I don't know enough about it. You know, what I would really like to do is go through and write up 5 to 10 pages on all sorts of things. And the axion would be one of them. This dilaton would be one of them. The Higgs particle. You know, even things like the top quark, just to figure out what the hell they are. That might not sound very good, but I mean, really, that's really the way to figure out these sorts of things is to figure out what they are. And I'd really like to do it with these sort of theoretical medium particles.
Yeah, I've wanted to look into the inflaton also. I had never heard of the dilaton. I think this may be an original idea to his supergravity theory, I think, because I've never seen dilaton anywhere before, I don't think. The inflaton is another one that comes up when you're looking at the inflationary epoch of the universe. So I don't know how much real theoretical basis there is for this and how much of it is just, you know, sometimes these things look like guesswork.
I think the dilaton shows up whenever you have extra dimensions.
Okay.
You know, I think some of these things just show up, and I think some of them are there because of the language that people use. So when you're looking at a lot of these equations, these Hamiltonians, these terms in the Hamiltonians correspond to particles and fields and things like that. How much is there a difference between a particle and a field? I don't really know.
I think you need one for the other. That's as far as I've figured it out. It's hard to have a field without a particle, right?
Yeah. So you end up writing these actions or these Hamiltonians or something like that, and you have all of these terms. So each one of these terms corresponds to something like, you know, the dilaton, right? Or the graviton or whatever. And so you say, okay, I've got this action, this is my graviton, and this is what's causing my gravity. And that's possibly just because of the way, say, QED was originally written. And not just because it was successful, but because that's the language everybody's using now.
Well, and, you know, predictive power, it's had a lot of that. And I guess that's the winning, that's the name of the game, right?
In a strong way, that's what you care about, is predicting things.
I wonder how he eliminates the problem of, like, causality within this theory. I didn't find anything that really explicitly explained what limits motion in the other dimension of time.
It didn't sound like he explained that to me. But the topics that he had here and the size of the papers that we read, I'm not surprised that he didn't explain everything. And that sounds like that's either a really, really complicated topic or such a simple topic that for somebody who already understands it, that he can't be bothered with taking the 50 pages of what he considers elementary theory to explain it to us.
Yeah, there was a few times in his lectures when some poor guy would throw out a question that was obviously very rudimentary to him, and he would get sort of a slightly impatient quality in his response, and he'd be like, but we already explained that over here. Remember when we went over this? And they're like, oh yeah, okay, I'm an idiot. It's all right. And I always liked that guy because having him go back over it and point out these things kind of helped me figure out what he was talking about better.
Yeah. If you have a question, you should ask it because, you know, half the room has the same question.
That's a good point. So, no, it was just funny to see the scientists in the room listening to a couple of his lectures often had that look on their faces that the little rascals would have whenever, like, Alfalfa was singing. They were just like, I think I'm following this, but man, I'm afraid of asking a dumb question.
Well, I mean, it's very specialized. I think even in high energy physics, it would be considered very specialized.
And I think that a lot of the people, it seems, who have the qualifications to really follow what he's saying and understand it and work with it, seem to be really absorbed in their, like, M theory and things like that, right? And it just seems like they haven't gone off to follow up on this.
There's a lot of truth to that. And I think he has a lot more freedom than a lot of those people do. I listened to one of them at work, which is probably not a really good thing because I was doing lots of other stuff at the same time. But it was pretty obvious that most of the people that were in the audience, students. And I don't know if that meant postdocs and graduate students or just graduate students. I'm assuming it was mostly postdocs, but still, they probably don't have very much freedom in what they can work on. So they have to make those decisions on what they're doing and what they're thinking about with the idea that someday they get a job. And unless there looks to be a lot of grant money in doing this particular research thing, they're probably going to stick with the main line, and branching out doesn't necessarily help you. I mean, you'll notice that on most of these papers, it's just him. And so he's not really getting too many people in there with him. And that might be just because he knows what it might mean for them on the job market later on as well.
Well, he published a book, which I get the impression, because I've read a little bit of it, the opening of it, called Extra Dimensions in Space and Time, a guy named John Turning. And Lawrence Krauss, one of my favorite astrophysicists, wrote a foreword for that book, and that was in 2010. So it's nice to see them, you know, collaborating on a book. I think I might have to buy that just to get my head around this some more and see what can be done with it and see what else he's done with it that might not be as evident from these really technical papers.
Yeah, did you take a peek at the price of that book?
No. Is it a lot?
For the sort of thing it is, it's not too bad, right? It's, I think, between $50 and $100.
No wonder I couldn't find a PDF online.
I'm a liar. The paperback is $114.20.
Ouch. Wow, I just looked it up on Amazon, and the hardcover is like, it's out of stock. The paperback is, yeah, as much as you just said. It's like they've got a listing for the hardcover at like $51, but there's none of them available. The paperback is twice as much. Shit. Well, I guess somebody likes it if they're running out of them. Well, I think I'll have to ask for that for Christmas, maybe. You know, one of the things that really caught my attention, one of the reasons this theory caught my attention when I first saw it, I guess it was 10 or 15 years ago when I first saw that he was working on this. It spun my head because I had actually heard this idea before, that there was another dimension of time perpendicular to the direction that we're experiencing daily. I had heard about this decades earlier when I was studying metaphysics, that mystics, I believe it was Eastern mystics, had talked about there being another dimension of time that's at a right angle to the one that we experience, and they call that dimension eternity, so that they could distinguish it between ordinary time. And apparently that's sort of what the whole mystical thing is about, is that when you get so present and conscious in the moment that your consciousness opens up and you can perceive an additional dimension of time. So it just shocked me to see that a physicist was working on this, because I'd always been fascinated by that idea. And I'd never heard anything in the literature about it. So I just figured, it's just more fairy tale from the ancients. But to think that, you know, wow, for thousands of years, the mystics have been talking about this. And here's somebody that's working it out, and it looks like it's kind of working. That was kind of a shocking resonance in my mind, you know?
I mean, a lot of times you see these things, but like I was trying to say earlier, that, you know, there have been previous attempts at this sort of 2T physics, right? Or not this 2T physics, but on having a second time dimension. And they have some issues.
This is, because they hadn't worked out the whole thing, right? So they ran into the ghosts and the negative probabilities and all that kind of jazz?
Yeah, so it's sort of the other way around, is that he got to this through the symmetry, and without that symmetry, and this gauge symmetry in particular, so this symmetry that, as long as you're paying attention to it, it constrains what your theory can do. Without that, the two times are really hard to get an idea for, but I think that's what you would be thinking of. That's at least the way I've always tried to imagine two times. So, you know, lots of times, especially when you're trying to read fiction, but lots of times you're reading these things and you're trying to get an idea about what's going on when they're saying, okay, now I've, you know, shifted a dimension in this way or something like that, but, you know, I can't really go back to the first dimension because I've already changed the blah, blah, you know, all those weird things. So when you're trying to figure out what's really going on with stuff like that, you get this idea about the second time. There has to be some second time dimension in order to have these things moving the way they're moving. And it's that sort of theory that I think is natural, that would be natural for a mystic, that is also the sort of thing that creates the ghosts and the causality problems and so on. I'm not sure how much of that stuff is left over for this, right? Because, I have some problems interpreting it because I'm not completely sure what's going on with that symmetry. I don't really know why that's constraining it.
Yeah, me either.
And so I have a hard time thinking that I can interpret this the way I'd like to interpret having two times. I keep getting stuck with that shadow.
With that what?
With the shadows. So, you know, you shine a light over here and you've got a Twister. Shine a light over there, you have, you know, Minkowski space or whatever. Though I guess you don't get a Minkowski space, but let's just say. So that's making me think that when you've got an object, that object is completely six-dimensional in this theory. And as long as the object is really a six-dimensional object, right, going along in six dimensions, and all you're getting is a shadow, like, yeah, I mean, exactly that, shining a light on something that can look like a cube or a sphere, depending on which angle you're shining the light at, then you don't get into a lot of the stranger ideas that you can get from thinking about two times, because you're still stuck with one object.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that even though physically it might not be possible to exploit that a full six-dimensional object in a way that would violate what we know is causality or the laws of physics, perhaps it's possible to become conscious of that six-dimensional object.
Yeah, that would be a strange idea. Do you have any of that DMT stuff around?
And I don't, but maybe that would be a gateway.
Yeah, so I think that would be fairly hard. But anyways, I remember thinking about these sorts of things and trying to get that kind of angle on reality and, you know, never really making it. I have this feeling that the perspective that we're looking at has more to do with how we're physically, I don't want to say incarnated because it doesn't really mean anything, how our atoms are moving. It's a frame of reference that we're not really able to sneak out of. It's kind of like saying, well, you know, if you go really, really fast, everything shrinks. You can really only get that idea in analogy, right? And you can draw it a little bit and you can play around with it a little bit, but it's still always an analogy to what it would really look like to observe something in Lorentz contraction. I think that's where you're going to be stuck with, is that you're going to be stuck in this frame, in this gauge, and you're not going to be able to transfer your gauges. It would be really fun to be able to, you know, he's got, what are the eight different things here, whatever, eight different gauges that he was looking at.
Yeah.
It would be great to be able to shift your position from one to the other and back again. But I think the best you're going to be able to do is figure out a good analogy, which would be hard enough. So a lot of these would be hard enough to figure out, even in the analogy, how to display it in such a way that you felt like you were experiencing or felt like you were getting at the experience of seeing those things, which is, you know, something you'd really love to be able to do.
Well, yeah, or to even disperceive them, you know, it's...
Yeah, what I'm saying is I don't think you can perceive them. I think the best you can get at is an analogy.
I'm not so sure about that, though, because isn't the idea here that reality itself is a six-dimensional reality and that we only perceive the three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. But if reality truly is six-dimensional, we also are six-dimensional, but we're only conscious of the shadow. But that might just be like a conditioning of our mind, that maybe if we could kind of escape that conditioning for a moment and just observe with our full consciousness, maybe we'd actually see into some of this. Maybe we'd see the higher dimensional reality. I mean, I'm not saying that we could act on it or do anything to it, but I mean, if the reality of the universe is a six-dimensional one, then that has to also apply to us too, right?
I mean, it would have to apply to us, and we'd be sort of stumbling around in those two other dimensions, except for the gauge symmetry.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that ends up really meaning in the long run. All you can do is sit around and try to figure it out, and, you know, maybe with or maybe without substances, I'm not sure.
Well, I think that when the Buddhas and people like that were talking about it, for them it was just a sense of liberation, because in this state of consciousness that they're talking about, where they're witnessing eternity, they see their own consciousness sort of in everything and in all at onceness. So maybe it's just this really direct kind of liberating experience to be like, oh wow, I'm not trapped in this. My entire existence isn't consisting of just three dimensions of space and one of time, but in this extra dimension, you know, a kind of I'm connected with everything. Maybe that's what it's all about. Maybe if you can see into an extra dimension of time, you see something about your own nature that you didn't apprehend before, and it's awesome.
Well, maybe so. It would be nice to have some direct apprehension of this. It would be even nicer if you can find that direct apprehension to sort of codify it. I mean, if you can actually figure out how to do it, right? If you can actually figure out how to see something like that, then it would make sense to me that you should be able to figure out a way to actually make an experiment. If you can really, really see it, and I guess if you're trained in...
theoretical physics?
Not theoretical physics, maybe high energy experimental physics, then maybe you should be able to figure out, oh, well, all I have to do is build this accelerator around the equator, blah, 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 and everything will be okay. You know, see a little blip with a mass of whatever, it's obvious what's happened.
It's a shame that we haven't had a mystic that had a great facility with physics and experimental science. You know, that'd be pretty cool. David Bohm. He talked to a mystic named Jiddu Krishnamurti, and they did a series of interviews, and I think there's some transcripts of their talks. David Bohm was talking to him to try to get insight into the nature of quantum physics. Yeah, it's interesting, and he did some good work. I've heard some of those talks, actually, and they were really fascinating. Clearly two very sharp minds talking about some really heavy stuff. It was really fun to hear a real scientist talk to a real mystic, you know? Yeah, I think especially with quantum mechanics, it kind of, when it got into the whole, like, observer was part of the experiment thing, it seems like a lot of people went seriously metaphysical with physics. And that's why I really love the work that we've done so far in covering, like, the pilot wave theory and things like that. It really brings it back down to a practical sensibility. Things aren't, the cat isn't alive and dead inside the box with the Schrodinger's cat and that kind of stuff, like. Make sense of the universe again. There's definitely a place for physics, and the only really interesting place that I've ever found where physics and mysticism meet was in that the fact that I heard about the two times at a right angle to one another, you know, years before I heard about this fascinating theory by Isaac Barrs, and that's all they have in common is that it's the idea, but it just fascinates me that the idea came from two totally different, unrelated, and disconnected realms, you know. And it's a neat idea. I love the idea of an extra dimension of time. I don't know if it means anything in practice. I don't know if we'll ever be able to, you know, physically access through some kind of experiment, maybe, an extra dimension of time. But it's really neat to think about.
Yeah, all these things are kind of fun to think about. You know, I mean, if you're looking at things from a physical point of view, you really want to look at somehow, somewhere, what's the experiment? And that always ties you down. But if you're looking at things the way maybe some theoretical physicists do, I don't know, because I'm not one, and definitely the way mathematicians do, you can just say, like, well, what if? And we saw that when we were talking about these gravitational theories, is that, you know, every once in a while, people just said, what if? And sometimes they just said, what if, just to get a better idea about what was going on with general relativity, right? What if I add a term over here? All sorts of strange things happen, but that helped me understand what was this whole general relativity thing was about in the first place. And that's why you had some really good physicists at the very beginning of general relativity doing some of that stuff.
It's kind of like musicians playing with a fun harmony. They're like, hey, what if we do this?
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's, one, it's fun to do, and two, it really gets you into what's going on. That's more or less the way they work. And, you know, I'm sure if it's Isaac Barrs, if he looked at this thing and said, you know, it didn't work, then he'd say, oh, well, I'll have to look at something else. But, you know, but he's been doing this for 20 years and just seeing that it goes over and over and over and getting better and better and better.
Yeah, I'm so excited for him, and I'm so grateful that there are people out there like him, who have such an intense love for the field and the process that they're willing to take these leaps into directions that nobody's looked at before, and to hell with repercussions for the grant money and the talks on the lecture circuit and stuff. They just want to find out some new truths, and they're willing to break out into new directions to get there. That Dragan Ajdukovic from CERN is another one that I love because he's another rebel. He's like, the hell with it. You know, this might not be the popular way to look at it, but I'm going to try to see what happens if we do this crazy thing with antimatter.
That's what makes a lot of this so interesting, is that they've just said, let's do something and let's see what would happen. And a lot of times it fails. And, you know, that's why when we've gone through general relativity. We said, look at all these tests. I think we did an entire show just on look at all these tests for a theory of general relativity. Make up some theory of gravitation. It has to be able to do the, explain this and 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 this.
It's a long list, yeah.
Yeah, there are people out there that still, despite all the dauntingness of that list, right, look at all the things that it actually has to do, try to figure out ways to make a better gravitational theory.
Yep, and that's what I loved about Carver Mead, too.
And that's the reason why we're talking about things here, I think, is just to look at stuff like that and just see some of the amazing ideas that people can get.
Yep, and if any one of these really refreshing and novel concepts is vindicated in the next few years, it'll transform our understanding of reality entirely.
All right, do you have anything more about this that you want to talk about?
No, I think that's a good note to part on this this episode, and let's do a little chatting and see what we can come up with to have some fun next time.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for talking, Randy.
Thank you, Jim. You have a good night.
You bet. Bye now.